Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I am Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamant.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you today, Robert?
Today, Russell, I am feeling vibrant. And I'm feeling geometric. And I've actually been thinking a lot about, well, actually looking at light coming in through my window, because I have a beautiful tree now in my garden. And on a day like today, thank God it's become sunny again, because the British summer this year has been a bit wet, especially in Margate.
But gray.
It seems like we're getting a later summer, luckily. And I've been getting this beautiful light, and it changes throughout the day. And it got me thinking about today's guest, because their work frequently refers to kind of temporal conditions, you know, like the passing of time. And I've always been really struck by the way that they use color and shape and form, and they sort of create sculptures that will improve your experience of the everyday, because often they have work in the public realm. And recently, I obviously haven't, I've been spending my summer in the UK, and I actually did a kind of city break to London, and there's been this incredible installation high up in Piccadilly on the streets of these beautiful geometric flags, which we're going to be talking about today. And also the guest we're about to meet has an amazing show currently on at The Box in Plymouth, and it's been a touring show of this most incredible installation, which also relates to this concept of dappled light. So we are very, very proud to welcome the wonderful artist,
Rana Begum.
Hi, Rana.
Hi, Rana.
Oh, hello.
How are you?
I'm good. So nice to meet you.
And actually, we can see trees behind you and in fact, dappled light, perhaps.
Yeah, this is my amazing view that I wake up to every morning, and I absolutely love it each morning. It's just so different, and you know, whatever the weather, it's so incredible. And I actually love it when it rains and windy, and you know, sometime you have sun coming through, and it just feels like you're somewhere quite exotic.
Yeah, because you've got like a corner window behind you, and you've got, I don't know what those are, that looks like birch trees potentially behind you.
So they're kind of, actually, this is Abney Park Cemetery. So when you walk through, there are lots of actually interesting plants in there. But yeah, these are kind of the basic ones that you see. I can't remember what they're called.
Really beautiful.
But they really, the cemetery is kind of overgrown, and it's one of the Magnificent Seven cemeteries in London. And I just asked,
is that a real thing?
Yeah. There is.
I'd never heard that.
Yeah, I absolutely love it. So they've won actually lottery funding to restore the cemetery. There's a little church in the middle as well. So yeah, they've been working really hard, kind of. It's just so beautiful in there. So if you are in Hackney, definitely go in there for a walk.
That's where you're based and your studio is as well.
I am, yeah. I'm based in Hackney, and I love it. Absolutely love the area. You know, my kids go to school here, and you know, everything is walking distance, so I don't have to kind of venture out very far.
And you live above your studio?
Yes.
Is that a budgetary thing, or is that just something that happened? Is that, do you need to be near the work? And
I think basically I'm quite obsessive, and you know, when you have kids, obviously they take priority, and then you've got to fit your work in whatever time you have available. So I bought this warehouse in 2011 with the hope of building a living space and a workspace, which would mean that I could prioritize the kids and my work. So it's taken me, it's been a 10-year project, and it's been amazing to have this kind of closeness with the work. And it means that when the kids go to sleep, I can go down and work.
Oh, cool.
And you never sleep yourself then.
Actually, oh my God. So yesterday and today, my energy level has been quite high. And when I'm like that, I can actually work without eating and sleeping. Yeah.
That's your superpower.
Yeah,
that's
like
amazing.
A clarity of vision or something.
Our
wow.
superpower.
So London's played a big role in your life, because you studied in London in the late 90s, I think. And then 20 years later, you were actually made a Royal Academician, literally 20 years later. It's amazing, in 2019. And then now you've kind of got this amazing installation of these geometric different shapes on these flags all the way through Piccadilly. So what does that feel like to sort of, you know, have grown up as an artist within this city that you love so much, and now in the centre of the heart of the bustling capital, your work is there?
This is all with Art of London, which is happening. I was there the other week. I was introducing the cubes with the National Portrait Gallery. Oh, yeah. And it's this incredible, these outdoor exhibitions, these public artworks. And yeah, as Rob said, you're an RA, but this was a collaboration with the RA as well, these flags.
Yes, it did come through the Royal Academy. Yeah, I mean, it's been kind of quite strange seeing my career develop, but it's been kind of a slow progression, which I absolutely love. I think it's been interesting and challenging. I never imagined to be in a position where I could say that I am earning a living from what I do. I think my ambition was kind of to have somewhere where I can, you know, even a shed at the bottom of the garden to be able to make work. And that I would have been happy with. So this, to me, sometime I have to kind of pinch myself and think, am I really here? You know, and it is incredible. And, you know, it's been a lot of hard work as well. And I think, yeah, I've enjoyed kind of the ups and downs of, you know, of the art world, and it's been interesting. And being made a Royal Academician, you know, that's a whole nother thing that I mean it's interesting as well to be amongst a peer group that you admire, respect, and to know that they've kind of selected you is obviously incredible. But then it has a side to it as well that you sometimes kind of feel uncomfortable about, you know. So yeah, there's lots of kind of mixed feelings.
Can we press you on that then? Is that because of the history of the RA and the fact that it was very patriarchal for many, many years?
Yeah, and it's just, you know, I don't think I'm better or worse than anyone else. I don't think it gives me any kind of power. I think that's something that you really kind of, yeah, that's something that I'm still kind of mulling over in my head, and what it means and how I come to terms with it, or, you know, work with it, if you like. But what I do love, like, for instance, you know, the summer exhibition, for instance, is incredible. I worked on it last year. And, you know, that's an opportunity where you really get to kind of show work with artists that you've never met and, you know, don't have opportunities to show in places like that. So there are, you know, really positive things.
So can we talk about these flags then that are going all the way down Piccadilly, and they have this beautiful motif, which is this geometric mosaic intricate design. And I don't know how many flags there are, but there's something really beautiful about the repetition, because they go all the way down as the eye can see. How did this collaboration with Art of London come up, and what is it like to have work on a big scale like that in a public sector?
So there are a few questions there. So there's
bombarding.
So that collaboration came through the Royal Academy, and as an RA, you know, you get approached to do various things. And I found it quite interesting because I liked the idea. I've been working on a project actually in Bristol for a music hall, and that commission has been going on for about 4 or 5 years now. And it's actually a progression from that commission. And the commission in Bristol is kind of textile based, and it's a material that I've been interested in for a long time. I haven't had an opportunity to kind of work with and develop. And so the Bristol Commission gave that opportunity, and that when I got approached to do the Piccadilly flags, I took it from that. And it's exploring kind of movement, it's exploring change of colour and how, you know, things kind of shift and whether it's noticeable, kind of that shift, basically.
Did they come to you and say, what would you like to do? It has to be above head height along Piccadilly.
Yeah,
what would you...
I was given some perimeters to work with. So it has to be, you know, at certain height, it has to be tied across the buildings, and it has to be something that kind of also works with the elements. So we explored different material, but unfortunately, because of various kind of limitation and health and safety, we couldn't go down that route. So we had to go back to kind of the printing method. And that's how...
One of the things I really love about it is this idea of time passing as well, and a kind of melody almost. That there's some kind of, within the movement as you're walking, it almost sings to you. There's something about the
jazz,
mosaics.
Isn't it?
Yeah. And I know the Art of London were really interested in this idea of art of entertainment, which in a way you wouldn't necessarily immediately associate with art. But I love the way that you've managed to create an artwork that is actually sort of joyful and about melody almost.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, when you think about entertainment, you think about sound and music, and so I think, I mean, we, you know, I am, my work is definitely, you know, I would say inspired by music, inspired by repetition, inspired by rhythm. So that kind of felt like a perfect fit to kind of respond to something like that with, you know, what's being worked on in the studio. So whatever public art commission that I do, it always links with what's happening in the studio. And so, yeah, Russell, you were asking about public art. I absolutely love having my work in that kind of realm, because I think it's an opportunity to kind of, for the work to really respond to the location and the function of the space and the challenges, the natural kind of challenges. You know, for instance, Catching Colour on City Island, you know, that was a really challenging location. And we've, again, that was a project that we worked on for about 4 years. And the reason it was challenging in the location is kind of like a wind tunnel. And so... yeah, it really kind of affects the way you make the work, the material you use, and how, you know, something is kind of stands the elements, basically. Mm. So,
well, this one, especially because it's a public commission, but in general, you are an artist that considers an audience. There's some artists that make work and they just make work because they love it. And I'm sure you do have that side of you, but the work that we all see, the audience feels like they are the activation for your artworks. You are looking for an audience.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I don't think about it in that way. I think I think about how someone uses the space, and I think about how they kind of navigate the space and the way they move. So it's about kind of capturing different kind of moments within the work. There's a curator, you know, Ziba Ardalan had kind of said quite beautifully about my work that, you know, it has kind of dual experience, most of my work. And that was something that I was kind of really, I feel much more and more kind of conscious about my work. And it's about creating those kind of moments where it's kind of bright, vibrant, incredibly kind of active. And then there are moments where it's kind of quite calm, quite contemplative. And I really like those kind of shifts that you have. And I think that kind of stems from me not being able to focus or keep the focus on something for a very long time. So I need to have something that's kind of constantly kind of questioning and active. And
so you personally feel like you can't focus, but you want to hold the viewer's attention.
I don't necessarily want to hold the viewer's attention. I want the viewer to be able to come back, keep coming back to the work and discovering something else that they haven't discovered. So it's not necessarily about producing something that you stand there and stare at. You know, you could just walk past and you can notice something that, you know, light falling on it, and it just interacts with the light and the space, and something happens and you think, oh, I didn't notice this about the work. And that's why I think also for me, you know, the change of light is really important, and why I feel constantly those kind of fleeting moments I'm trying to capture in my work.
I like the idea that the work is almost alive in a way.
Yeah.
You know, and it's got its own kind of universe even without being looked at.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like it's existing, like you're aware of its existence even without a viewer,
That's a really beautiful way of putting it. And I also love the fact that, you know, how you're saying kind of time passing. You know, I guess it's also about kind of slowing down a little bit, which I'm not very good at doing.
Oh, interesting. So the art sort of provides for you a space where you can slow down, perhaps.
Yeah, kind of just makes you pause. And I think that's kind of the experience I have, you know, when you're walking down the street or, you know, anywhere in the world, whatever city you're in. You know, I think sometimes we can forget where we are. We can forget why we're there, or, you know, forget to observe.
I first discovered your work through the wonderful London gallerist Kate McGarry. And the thing that always struck me about your work was it's always identifiably yours. Like if I see a work by you, I know it's a Rana Begum work. But you use so many different materials. Yeah. And I've always been really impressed by the expanse of materials you use, from like whether it even be basket, almost like basket weaving, or like, you know, perspex kind of sheets, or metal or mesh, or and also there's often a lightness to the work somehow, because even though it is a big sheet of perspex, it's really about how the light is going through all those different colours and how the time of day passes and the shadows move through it. So even something that's quite solid and heavy, it becomes very light and quite sensorial and quite, I don't know, soulful.
Yeah, it can be quite contradictory, if you like, in terms of some of the materials that I use. But I don't know, I feel incredibly lucky and fortunate to be an artist, and to be an artist that can, you know, be affected by people and the space around you, you know, around. It's, we're incredibly fortunate to be in that position. And so to limit oneself to a medium or an approach to an idea is, I think it's a shame. I think, I don't know. I mean, this is one of the reasons why I did art. I remember actually doing my foundation course at Hertfordshire University. And I remember just being wowed by the possibility of art and, you know, the direction it could go. You know, and there were moments where I was thinking, oh, I'd really like to be an architect, I'd really like to be a designer, I'd really want to go into textile, printmaking, sculpture. And everything I did, I just couldn't pull myself away from those kind of discipline. And I thought, well, you know, when it came to finally choosing, because obviously, you know, I had to choose which degree I was going to do, which master's, I was thinking, this is ridiculous, the fact that I have to kind of limit myself. And so I ended up doing painting, because painting, for both my BA and MA, it really gave me that possibility, you know, to use whatever materials and to experiment, to try things out. And I feel like, you know, my core interest has always been color, light, and form. And those three things kind of run through all the different series of work. And I feel like, you know, I can still kind of have that identity. Not that that worries me. I think I'm kind of driven by the interaction between color, light, and form and what certain material does. Yeah, and so I'm kind of really fascinated by how light would activate those kind of three things.
When did you find light as a material then? I think I read this story about growing up in Bangladesh as a kid, yeah, and you strayed off into a male-only area because you were fascinated and transfixed, yeah, by the light that you were seeing.
Yeah, this was actually through, I love therapy. I've been getting therapy for years, and it was actually, I think it was after I had my second child. It was connecting this moment of, you know, growing up as a child to my work and kind of making sense of why I desperately needed light. Even when building this place, you know, I remember giving a brief to the architect and saying, you know, light, and I don't want to wear any thermals, you know, so there were kind of, and no water feature in the building. those were the three main things.
Why no water feature?
Oh my god, because they're
your bugbear, you don't like them.
No, I love water, but originally this building used to be an engineering factory and it was asbestos covered roof, and I lived and worked in here secretly, and it was constantly leaking.
Oh, it was just because it'd be triggering now if you saw water in the house. Right.
Noticed, like, yeah. No water feature. I want a leak-proof building. So, you know, like, it was cognitive analytical therapy. And, you know, where it delves into your kind of childhood and looks at kind of, you know, reasons why, you know, why you are what you are as an adult. So I loved that.
Me too. Attachments. I'm all about attachments. Yeah. Tell me.
And, so there was kind of this moment, you know, where she was asking about what it was like growing up as a child in Bangladesh. And I kind of remember thinking back that I was quite a loner. You know, I used to kind of wander around by myself a lot. And, you know, I remember my mum kind of screaming at me, you know, for sitting and staring into the space and getting bitten by mosquitoes. You know, and she'd just be like shouting at me, just get back in the house, you know. And I spent a lot of time out wandering the fields. And I kind of was wondering, well, why was I doing that? And so the more I looked at it, the more, you know, the memory of kind of sitting and staring and what I was looking at was coming back. And so Bangladesh, where I grew up, there were kind of two bathing pools, one for men and one for women. The women's bathing pool was kind of very discreet and kind of screened off, but the men's was open, and you know, you had a lot of kind of natural light. So I used to hang out there a lot when it wasn't being used, and the reflection and the light was so beautiful. And I also spent a lot of time kind of the rice fields, that kind of intense green. So all of those things, it was such a wonderful connection, and it made sense. For me, so many things made sense. This kind of need and drive to be around light and different kind of light, and also kind of movement and just being able to kind of, yeah, I mean, even this view, I love spending time with this view. I love spending time just staring into kind of this. I think I can be quite hyper and quite active. And so I'm always striving for this kind of calmness in my work. And actually, I remember Tess Duray, who's an artist that I assisted for about 5 years, and she's my mentor, and she's someone that I kind of go to. And she'd said something about how, you know, we're always trying to achieve something in our work that we can't achieve in ourselves, you know, so the work is a kind of reflection of what we want our life to be. And I thought that was quite interesting, you know, constantly trying to achieve perfection in my work, which I cannot.
It's interesting thinking about that, the water spaces as well for the swimming. It's almost like the way that light reflects onto water and like the ripples within the water. It kind of makes me think about the rhythm within those flags as well. There's something quite like, I don't know about that movement of nature. Yeah.
I wasn't sure if that was going to be achievable at that scale, at that height. And because also the flags are quite far apart, whether you could see the effect of it.
But I think the use of colour, because you've got different colours as it goes
it changes
through. Oh, yeah, that's true, actually. The sky is connected to the work. If we're thinking about your use of colour in different materials, there's an amazing show on at the moment, also in the UK, in Plymouth at The Box, which is a wonderful contemporary art centre. And it's called Dappled Light, which is very apt. and it's been touring around the world. So it's been in Dubai. I think it was in Warwick and in Ealing and other places.
Yeah.
What's it like to have a work like that travels through different places? Do you experience it in a completely new way each time?
Yeah, so the show originally kind of started at Mead Gallery in Warwick, and it was kind of in response to the new space and also looking at the new kind of series in my work. So, you know, I had this show with Parasol Unit in 2016, which really showed kind of the progression in my work and gave a narrative that's quite difficult to have with abstract work. And after that show, I knew there was a sense of like departure, there was a sense of it was going somewhere else. And so the show Mead Gallery was kind of really in response to that, where the work is now, and really responding to the new space there as well. And then the opportunity came for the work, the show, the entire show to tour. And I really struggle with, like I said, you know, with the sameness, I think. So things have to change, things have to shift. And a lot of my work really responds to architecture. So it didn't make sense for the show to be exactly the same, you know, when it was going to different locations. So it was very different when it was at Pitt's Hanger, you know, and again, that was an incredible space. And
I'd never heard of it, actually. And it's an amazing building, like Sir John Soane designed it.
Yeah.
And the room where you, you know, had your artwork suspended in space was actually next to this giant dome, this kind of stained glass dome.
Well, he was someone that brought in light in a really interesting way. And again, you know, when you go to the Soane Museum as well, I mean, I absolutely love how, you know, when you walk through the museum, how beautiful it is in the way he brings light in, and you really see all the different kind of components and, you know, detail in the architecture. So that was a building that I've known for years and never thought I'd have the opportunity to show there. And I actually remember my ex having a group show there and thinking, oh my God, this is so incredible, I'd love to be able to show in this place. So when the opportunity came, I was just so excited to be and to respond to someone who is already, you know, really playing with light and really thinking about space was incredible.
I think he was so much about perception, wasn't he, really?
Exactly.
There's some kind of like profound subconscious relationship to light.
Yeah, but I mean, I felt like, again, light was also a material for him, you know. In the way that the cloud was kind of lit, you know, I remember installing, actually, I had COVID at the time and I wasn't allowed in the building. I was outside. And I just remember kind of as we started putting the cloud piece up, you know, it was just so beautiful. And I didn't want any artificial light in it. And then the opening came and it was in the evening, and suddenly realized, I was like, ah, okay, we do need some artificial light.
Right, right.
That was quite funny.
But these works for me are ones that I'm really drawn to, these kind of cloud bursts. Yeah. I think they're catching colour and they're made with all these multicoloured mesh, and they're room sized. They're huge, but they have this lightness of a cloud.
Yeah.
When did you start working on these? And the one that's in the box, Plymouth, is within like a church, like an old church. They've filled that space with it.
Yeah. So this is a series that kind of stemmed from these paintings that I've been doing for a few years. And the paintings come from another series that basically we have to, when we spray these bar section works, we have to check the spray cans for consistency and flow, you know, and how the paint kind of attaches to the surface. And so when we're checking each can, you're building up a layer, you're building up a narrative of what's been happening in the studio. And so those paintings we used to throw away. I can't believe. And then one day I was like, hang on a sec, just stop, you know, can I see this out of the spray room in the studio? And the more I was looking at it, the more I felt these paintings were sculptures. And I was like, there's something there. And for a few years, I just had them. We didn't show them anywhere. I just wanted to keep them in the studio. And then I was like, okay, you know, how do I bring it out into the physical space? And also, I loved this idea that your entire vision is kind of, it's filled with this. And so there is something about kind of having a connection with the body. So most of those that you'd see, they are at a level where you are physically can connect to them. And so that's, yeah, so I then started getting, you know, kind of wire mesh and started forming it and spraying them. And slowly, and they started off kind of really small, you know, things that you can hold in your hand. And I was like thinking, oh, this is really interesting. And I loved it when the light kind of fell on it. And then I was thinking, what would happen if I made it slightly bigger? And they just kept growing and growing and growing so big that you could barely pick up on your own.
Will they get bigger, do you think?
I don't know, but I'm still excited by this series.
They're brilliant.
I'm still interested in what happens, you know, when they go to a space. So it's kind of, yeah, I mean, there are moments where I'd stop a series and I'm not finding, you know, anything more. So this is quite a new series that we're still kind of pushing in the studio and trying things out.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
It's exciting, the kind of fine detail versus the giant expanse.
Yeah.
I'm really into all these dualities and these kind of contradictions in a way, which become this really positive energy force.
And that's so true. And actually, because you brought up something earlier, Robert, about, you know, how they might seem lightweight, but actually they could, you know, the material could be quite heavy. So there's a piece that I did in 2018, which is kind of made of glass, and it was for Freeze 2018. And, you know, again, like that's a really heavy sculpture. You know, it's two pieces of glass that's kind of laminated together. And you wouldn't think it, that's not what you experience, you know, first, you know, the first time you see it. Or even the work I made during my residency with Tate St. Ives, you know, inspired by Barbara Hepworth, I made these kind of floats and I made them with plaster and then I made them with marble. So it's kind of, I love this kind of contradiction. And I think that's kind of interesting. It makes you think, it makes you question. And I want my work to be doing that constantly. I want my work to kind of question your surrounding and the way you look at things.
Is it easy for you to think big? Is that like the architecture brain, like the flags that are going down Piccadilly, which seem endless, yeah, and these room-sized installations pieces that you're making? Does your brain automatically go bigger?
Not necessarily. I mean, I remember when I was at Chelsea, I didn't have the money, didn't have the space to make huge scale work. And, you know, I started making little models of it, you know, and I
like
would
maquettes,
kind of,
like,
yeah, little maquettes.
But I guess in your head, thinking of the bigger picture, though.
Thinking, you know, yes, and I was right. Like, you know, and I was wondering at that time, you know, I just wanted it to get bigger and bigger and I couldn't, you know. And I remember at the time I was really intrigued by the idea of the infinite. And so that's something that really was kind of pushing my work and pushing scale as well. So yeah,
I guess that's light is infinite, isn't it? I guess it's, yeah, like the possibilities of light.
Exactly. It's endless.
The way you describe your work is minimalist abstraction. And for people listening, yeah, what is that exactly? What is minimalism? And how did you find minimalism for yourself?
Well, I discovered minimalism during my foundation. I had this amazing tutor who saw my work and was like, I need you to come to the library now and I want to show you some stuff. And he took me to the library and he got books out on constructivism and minimalism. And I was just taken by it. And I was like, wow, this is amazing. This is incredible. So I was looking at people like Judd, Sol Lewitt, Frank Stella, Dan Flavin,
Agnes Martin, I think she was
Agnes in Martin. Yeah. And I was just like, I just absolutely love their work, but I didn't understand it. And this was a time where, you know, my English wasn't great and I'm still struggling to kind of read. So I'm dyslexic as well. So it kind of really, you know, I was really excited, but just didn't know how to kind of pursue this route without really understanding. So I took kind of a research approach, which is that I thought rather than going down a theoretical route, I went down a practical route and I wanted to kind of understand abstraction. I wanted to understand minimalism, constructivism. And I thought, you know, the best way to do that is through material, through physically making things. And so I came back to the studio and I looked at my work. And at the time I was doing a lot of figurative stuff. It was awful. And
painting
and drawing,
right?
You know, but there was something in those that I could see that was actually very abstract. And it was about light. It was about color. It was about form. And so I started making a list of things and immediately I could see how abstract everything was.
Right.
And so I then took the approach of looking at light and form initially. And then I think it was in the second year of my MA that I decided to focus on color and just primarily on color. And again, that was kind of through practical research.
How would you define minimalism for people listening that don't know what that is?
Well, for me, it's kind of reduction, kind of reducing something down to the most kind of basic material and form, where it's kind of feels very pure and feels very stripped back. And I think, you know, a lot of the work, I mean, sometimes people use illusion to describe my work, which I really don't like. So, I mean, I like to think that I'm not really trying to deceive the viewer. You know, as you get closer to the work kind of reveals itself, the material or the process gets revealed. So, yeah, I feel like minimalism is kind of going back to kind of the most simplest kind of
the purest form. Yeah. And constructivism, well, because we mentioned that, how did you find that in Rana's words?
I struggled with that, actually. I struggled with constructivism because I liked the idea of it, but I think it still felt too complex, too many layers, too many things happening. But it was interesting, and I think I needed to kind of go through that phase of constructivism and understand it and understand. And I think that really made me look at light in a way that I hadn't done before. So, yeah.
What is it, though? What is constructivism?
God, now you're putting me in the spot.
This is like art class.
Yeah, exactly.
I know.
That's brilliant.
I'm so sorry.
I just think like people listening who wouldn't know what that word is. And I think the whole point of our show is that we want people to feel like, oh, okay, that's a reference that I don't know what it is. Because if you're not in the art world,
you wouldn't
have any idea what constructivism is.
That's true.
Well, constructivism with art, though, was an early 20th century art movement, essentially, wasn't it?
Yeah, and it was an art movement that kind of really looked at kind of movement and building and lots of kind of elements and interaction as well. That's kind of how I see it. I mean, I might be getting it completely wrong.
No, I think that's right. And also, it was like modern industrial society that they were kind of looking at, and it was quite strict in some ways and in the forms of the shapes that they use, which in a way is actually quite different to what you do, because I think your work has a softer edge to it, if you know what I mean. Like, even if you think of the work at the box right now, it's almost like these clouds, like Russ described it as a cloud burst. Do you know what I mean? Like, yours are much more nature related.
Well, I think this was something that, you know, again, I felt like I was being pigeonholed, and that's something that I really don't like happening. And I have these moments in the studio where I feel like I need a break from hard edge geometry and kind of brutalist kind of forms. And so it's great when there is an element of kind of an organic kind of fluid approach where things can happen, something can go wrong, and that kind of throws up new questions and new ideas. And I love that. And I think, you know, sometimes when you're using a material, you can, you know, you can get bogged down by the function of it, or you can be really limited by, or you think, well, this material can only be used this way and that's it. Well, actually, no, you know, it doesn't have to be. There is no rules, and I think that's the kind of approach that I like to take, and I like to kind of have in the work element of organic geometry.
The two works we've been talking about today in London and Plymouth, the thing also that really strikes me in your work as a general thing is that you often don't use a plinth. So you're making sculptural interventions, but there's no plinth. And I know you studied at the Slade, and I heard that there was a whole movement where it was quite anti-plinth.
Oh, really?
And I know, like, there's lots of, well, not anti-plinth, but I think it's this idea that can sculpture be something that isn't just presented as an object to be fetishized or something.
Yeah.
And actually sculpture's potential is so much more than just an object sitting on a plinth. I'm not saying you can't make work like that. I'm just saying that within your work, it seems like you often have things hanging on the wall directly, which are sculptural, though, or you have installations like in the ground or, you know, hanging suspended like in the box. Do you know what I mean? Is that something you've ever thought about?
Like, no, you're right, actually. I mean, I missed out on the whole kind of that moment at Slade conversation.
I might be making it up.
No, I've heard that as well.
I thought it was Phyllida Barlow or something.
True, but I did painting. So,
oh, of course you did.
I did have a couple of conversations with Phyllida, which I loved. But yeah, I did painting, so I was allowed to do whatever I wanted. And, you know, a lot of my work were kind of wall-based. So I was always kind of striving for the work to come out of the wall into the physical space. And I do find actually plinth quite limiting and as almost like a barrier, you know, you put around the work. So my work has always been something that kind of interacts with the space. So it's a bit strange to, you know, to have it on the plinth. I struggle with that. And I always try and kind of, as much as possible, to remove the plinth. And there is a work that the Royal Academician that now owns, you know, and this is an early work that I'm finally letting go. But the way initially, its title is number 174, and it initially it was on a base that, you know, and that was the only way that it could kind of be held up. And I got it out recently and I was like, this is something that I really don't like. I don't want it. How can I move it away? And we've been working on it for months to find a solution to remove the plinth where it's just literally sitting on the floor and you could really see it with the material, whatever the floor is going to be. Yeah, for me, I definitely want to make work and love making work that really responds to a space, really responds to the floor, the wall, you know, the light in the space. Doesn't matter where it is. And I think there's something about when two materials kind of connect as well, whether they kind of touch or they just float above.
Or cross over each other.
Yeah, and I think it's to do with the kind of the sensory aspect of my work. You know, I feel a lot of the time, you know, it's, yeah, even though the first sensory is kind of visual for me, that's how I then kind of react, and then you'd get the kind of the goosebumps, you know, it's that kind of, you, it really makes you think about your position, your existent in the space.
So goosebumps is a feeling that you know when the work is good for you.
Not necessarily.
But sometimes.
Sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. How do you know when a work is ready then? What does that feel like then?
I was going to say, sometimes it's quite exhilarating. I mean, what are the words that you'd use to kind of mind-blowing, and you get really excited, you're screaming in the space and you're like wanting to share. There are other moments where it's just kind of silent and quite contemplative. So it really varies.
Something that struck me about your practice is the need for collaboration, not only with curators. I know you've worked with like Cliff Lawson recently and Sarah from The Box, but and also your gallery, I guess, Kate McGarry. How important is collaboration? Because I know you have a studio of people that assist you who are probably other artists themselves.
Yeah, it's really important. I love isolation, but I also love being around people and having conversation. We're a small team of artists, writers, designers, and I think it's so important to have conversation, to be critique of your own work and have other people, you know, be honest about your work as well. But I mean I've collaborated with architects, fashion designers, musicians as well. One of the early collaboration is with someone called Haytal and David Corney. He's amazing. It was quite funny. I remember he was introduced by Eddie Peak, and he came to the studio and he was like, I love your work. I really want to I want us to collaborate. And I was like, okay, but I haven't heard your music. And so we started listening and I was thinking, oh my God, this is not the kind of music we listen to in the studio. And this is not something that, and he was like, no, you know, I would really love to kind of collaborate and I want to find a way. And I was like, okay. So he left the album and, you know, we were listening to it in the studio, and the more I'd listen, the more I got into his music. So his music is electronic, and I just got more and more excited. And so we met up a few more times and spent time in the studio, played around with materials and light and sound, and tried to kind of pull apart his kind of, you know, track that we were interested in kind of using. And out of that process, a piece of work came out, which has artificial light and sound element to it and movement. And then Roxanda was someone that, again, I love the fact that it takes me out of my comfort zone, you know, and it really pushes my work, pushes the way I think and the way I look at my work. And I think we need to kind of, I think we can kind of sometime play too safe.
Roxanda's a fashion designer, sorry.
Yeah, she's amazing, yeah. Roxanda. And I can imagine you two, even though what you're doing is quite different, it also has shared sensibilities.
Oh my God, I love her clothes. I love how she, again, you know, I feel like, you know, that's where I can connect with Roxanda in the way she uses fabric and just, you know, doesn't see kind of a limit, you know, and how she pushes the structure of the fabric. You know, and you think, God.
But you've also made furniture, haven't you?
Yes.
Because I didn't know that. I found that out this morning. I was a bit like, wow, I didn't realize.
Yes, I was. I can't remember what year. It was the. I did Frieze one year, and furniture companies saw my work, and they were like, "Oh, can you design a piece of furniture?" And I kind of kept pushing it back further and further, and then it was kind of very last minute. They were like, you know, the deadline's running out now. We need something from you.
Deadlines are good for that reason. Deadlines are
good. And I was like, okay. So I was looking at my work, and at the time I was using a lot of triangles. So I started kind of folding paper and using kind of that geometry. And as I was folding, it kind of reconnected. And that was a really exciting moment. And I was thinking, wow, you know, that's kind of repeated geometry that creates this piece of furniture. But then when you also look at it from either end, the triangle flips. And anyway, so we made one in the studio, actually two. We made this tiny one, children version and then an adult version, and then we're like, okay, well, we don't have the equipment to make it in the studio, so we have to outsource it. And so at the time I was working with Structural Workshop, who are an engineer company that did this building, and I sent it to them, and I remember sending them all the information. I was like, can you do this drawing that I can then just send out to the fabricators? And he came back and he's like, no, Rana, you can't make it. This is not possible. And I was like, it is possible. You know, have a look at the photographs I have attached. And yeah, it was a really funny moment, kind of, you know, working with, again, kind of, you know, people that do something else completely. And yeah, I love those kind of conversations where, you know, you like kind of push yourself and see where the work will go. And I love how disciplines, you can blur the boundaries between the different disciplines.
Before we get into our final questions, I would love to discuss your titles or lack of title, rather, that you use a number. The work that's with Art of London is number 1273, Flags, that goes down Piccadilly.
I'm glad you remember that.
Why? And you said, well, you said the one about the RA that's an early work is 174.
174, yeah.
So when did numbers, is there a number one and number two and a number three, and do they exist still? And why did you decide earlier on?
Destroyed.
Oh no. So at what point do we get numbers that still exist? And why did you decide to have numbers instead of titles?
So I found myself spending a long time. This is when I was at Chelsea. I found that I was spending a long time to figure out titles and stressing about them. And I thought, this is kind of waste of my time, and it's time is valuable. I'd rather be, you know, making things than spending ages thinking about title and what they mean. And then I was thinking about actually how the viewer interacts with the work and what it is that I want them to take from the work. And I realized that when I go around art galleries or museums or, you know, look at public art, I'm not immediately drawn to finding out what the title is and what they mean and what all of those things, because I think they're not significant. I want to have my own perspective. I want to have my own view and emotions and reactions to the work. So, and that's where I just started thinking, well, actually then, you know, the title becomes an unnecessary component to the work. It's almost, you know, because the first thing you see is the work, not the title. And so, yeah, so I decided to kind of remove title from all my work, and they just get numbered in the order that they get finished, basically, which makes life so much easier.
What is the number up to now, and what number exists, the earliest number? If you say 123 was destroyed.
Yeah. Oh, God, that's a really difficult question. I can't look at it. But we're up to almost, I think, 2,500.
And it's just going to keep, I mean, for the rest of your career. So when it goes into, like, 10,000,
yeah,
it would just be, like, number 10,000.
Yeah. But then also, I also have works that are on paper. So that's a whole nother set of titling. So yeah, so that doesn't quantify the number of works I produce. I am a bit of a workaholic. I do make a lot of work. Not necessarily, not everything goes out. Not everything, you know, is visible. There are works that I don't feel happy about, but get a title and then they sit in the studio.
Well, you're talking to two workaholics here, and we really appreciate your energy. I think we're kindred spirits when it comes to that. Yeah. So we're moving on to our final questions. The first one is, Rana, if you could do an art heist, you could steal any artwork in the world for yourself, what would it be and why?
Well, actually, I am sitting with a artwork that I absolutely love. This is a painting by Testure. It's an early painting from the early 80s, and I absolutely love Tess's work, and she's someone that really, you know, has been just amazing to me, and I love conversations with her. And
she was your tutor at one point, right?
No, actually, I applied to the Slade because of Tess. But she retired the year that I got in.
Oh.
And so I didn't get a chance until, you know, you could select artists to come in to give you tutorials. And so I requested Testure as one of the artists, and we just hit it off, basically. And she offered me a job, a part-time job, and assisting her. And I love her early works. I love her new works as well, but I really wanted one of those early works. So yes, I'm living with one of.
So you're the only artist or the only person we've ever had on whose art heist they actually have already. So that's fantastic.
Tess makes amazing prints as well.
Oh my God, yes. And
I'd love to interview her.
Oh, you should. Definitely. She is hilarious. Okay. It would be very entertaining.
She's quite a pioneer, really.
Yes.
I love her. And she's also an RA, isn't she? The other question we ask every guest is, what is your favourite colour? And I'm really excited to ask you that.
That is the worst question you can
ask. I know.
That is like, I don't know, it depends on the day. You know, there are moments where I'd be like, bright yellow, and there will be moments where I want bright pink or red. So it really depends on the day. I love that pink, Robert, behind you.
Pink Panther, neon.
Pink Panther, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I use a lot of fluorescent colours in my work. So, you can't make me choose.
That's okay, fine.
We'll let you have all the spectrum of colour.
What is the best advice you've ever received when it comes to your work?
Oh God, that's a good one. I'm just trying to think. It was probably actually Tess. You know, don't let the outside world kind of dictate, you know, how you make your work or what you make. I think I remember actually us having a conversation about abstraction and how it's not in fashion and how, you know, figurative art was, you know, kind of taking the limelight. And I was like, well, I don't think it's, you know, I'm making work to kind of be in fashion. I'm not making work to be in the moment. I think that was something that was kind of really reassuring, just hearing, you know, having that conversation with her and knowing that you don't need to be kind of be going what the art world is saying. You can, yeah.
I love that. Well, this has been amazing, Rana. Your work with Art of London, the Art of Entertainment, the number 1273 Flags going along Piccadilly is up until August 20th. Your solo Dappled Light, which is at the Box in Plymouth, will be on until the 24th of September, and that's supported by the Henry Moore Foundation, who we love.
But also, you made a few works in response to Sir Joshua Reynolds, which are in a kind of concurrent exhibition called Reframing Reynolds. A celebration which goes on till the end of October. So there's plenty of opportunity if you're in the UK this summer, this autumn, to see Rana's work and experience it.
Yes, well, this has been brilliant. Thank you for coming on and giving us your
thank
time.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed our conversation. Great questions.
And thanks for making the work in London as well for everybody this summer, because it's such a generous thing. It's like a, I don't know, I love artworks that are just around us and kind of improve our experience of the everyday.
Oh, it's so important to have work in the public, and it's so important to have work that, you know, from lots of different artists. It's varied and makes you think about the space, makes you think about your connection to things, yeah.
And you can go to Instagram and follow at the Art of London, also the Box Plymouth. And are you on Instagram?
Yes, it's Rana Begum Studio.
Perfect. And I love your website, by the way.
Yes,
you've got such a... I don't even really often go to artists' websites, but yours is amazing.
Cloudburst.
It's a proper archive.
Thanks.
And the photography for your works is so beautifully done.
Yeah, like, wow. No, we try very hard to kind of... Yes, actually, it needs to be updated with more recent projects, because Desert X isn't on there, and I think City Island isn't on there. And so, yeah, there's lots of projects that we've done that needs to go on the website.
So, Ron, as well as those projects that we just said, what else is upcoming for you?
So I have a commission that is going to be unveiled at Bristol Beacon in October, and I also have a solo show coming up in St Albans, where I grew up at the museum there.
What is it like going back to St Albans then with work?
It is really strange. I mean, I go back because my family's still there, but it feels really strange going back there and to have a show, solo show there as well. I'm excited too. It's strange and exciting.
Brilliant. Looking forward to those.
Well, thank you so much. We'll be back very soon. Bye.
Cheers, Rana.
Bye, Rana. Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.